It'll come to order. There is a quorum present today, and Representative Lohmer would like to approve the minutes for March 17, 2015. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Lohmer. We're going to mix it up on the agenda a little bit this afternoon and start with Representative Zerwas and House File 1729. Representative Zerwas moves House File 1729 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Health and Human Service Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I'll talk through this briefly. As you all know, our medical assistance payments for outpatient medical services are abysmal. They've hardly had any increase over the last two decades. This is especially the case for our primary care services, office visits, immunization, and preventative services. The last statewide comparison showed that for primary care services, MA paid around 35% of what commercial payers reimburse for the exact same services. Most medical clinics run at about a 50% overhead cost, so physicians and other primary care providers in many instances are losing money on every MA patient that they serve. However, for the last 2 years, Congress increased medical assistance or Medicaid payments for primary care services across the country to the Medicare level and paid for with 100% of federal money. Well, that ended December 31st, 2014. And so House File 1729 reinstates that increase and continues it going forward. Minnesota would have to come up with its 50% state share to pay for this. A request has been submitted to DHS for a fiscal note, and we have an amendment that I want to have distributed, although we won't act on it today because we just got it this morning. But I want that fiscal note out so that we can, or that amendment out, so DHS can use that to base the fiscal note off of. Physicians and other primary care providers continue to serve MA patients, even though they're now once again losing money each time they do so. And so all of us should really commend our providers for continuing this work. But we must understand that this is an issue that needs to be addressed, and we need to begin addressing this through a statewide process and not patchwork. And so we need to continue to incentivize and really help make full our providers that participate in MA and Minnesota care. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I think there are a few testifiers, and then if I don't know if who on staff could walk through the A1 that we're not going to act on today.
Okay, thank you, Representative Zerwas. Mr. Chung, would you be able to walk through the A1 amendment for us?
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment just incorporates some, I guess, clarifications suggested by the Department of Human Services. And I think the intent is just to clarify the intent and to make it clear, I guess, on what date the new payment starts and on what date the new payment ends, and I think most importantly to better define the primary care providers that are being subject to the continuation of the higher payment rate.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chung. Representative Zerwas.
And Mr. Chair and members, thank you, Mr. Chung. And my understanding is DHS is working through the process with fiscal to come up with the fiscal note and the cost for this. And this was clarifying language that I had emailed to me. And I think the rest and some of the other members with the request saying that this would help with that fiscal note process and getting that finalized. And so that's what this is. It came in, I think, at about 9 o'clock this morning, so it's not something I'm asking the committee to act on today. However, I just wanted everybody to see the language that the fiscal note will eventually be based upon. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think we have some testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas, for that clarification. If there's anyone willing or interested in offering testimony, if you'd please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Susan Berry. I'm a pediatrician that practices here in the Twin Cities, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. So I'm here today representing our state's pediatricians. Hopefully you'll see some of them around today. And also the MMA and the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, specifically on behalf of the children we all care for, in support of House File 1729. So this file reinstates increases in the medical assistance payments for selective primary care services that have been effective, Representative Zerwas told you, in the last 2 years. This is critical because of the severely low payment levels that exist for physician services through medical assistance. We're currently 47th in the state, in the nation, in Medicaid physician rates. And for most clinics that serve MA patients, those payments are less than 40% of what commercial payers typically reimburse. They're not even high enough to cover the overhead costs, as you've already heard. So the evidence is clear. Adequate Medicaid payments are critical to ensuring that patients are able to access care, and access to primary care is particularly important for the children and for their parents. Congress acknowledged this and for the last 2 years required all states to increase their medical assistance payments, but even with that, that's below what commercial payers reimburse, and the result of this was actually what was intended. An average increase in primary care Medicaid payments of 73% resulted in a 36% bump in primary care Medicaid rates for us, and the outcome of that is demonstrated improved access to care. In a recent study, when they looked at this, the availability of primary care appointments for Medicaid patients increased by nearly 8% with no increase in primary care appointments in the private insurance group during that same time period, about 2013 to 2014. Another study found that when more doctors accept Medicaid, fewer children and teens experience issues with access. Fewer kids experience, the study also found that almost 16% of children with significant health conditions or developmental delay during that time experienced difficulty in getting a clinic to accept their insurance when Medicaid was a barrier. So that increase ended, as was noted, on December 31st, and we hope that you'll consider reinstatement to the Medicare level. Obviously, this requires us to pay a 50% share, but a lot of other states have signed on with this, and there's states from all over, whatever you want to call them, all colors, Iowa, Maryland, Alabama, Mississippi, Colorado, have all undergone a hick in this and seen these benefits. So my organization, from the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Family Physicians, and the MMA, really would like to encourage you to do this. As I understand it, one plan for this may be to include this in the omnibus bill. That makes sense to me. This helps access. This makes a difference for children and families, and it allows broader investment in primary care services so that physicians can really accomplish a career in primary care, and access to care is assured.
Thank you, Dr. Berry, for the testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 1729? Seeing none, I'll move to member questions. Are there questions for the testifier or for Representative Zerwas? Seeing no questions from members, Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 1729 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Service Omnibus Bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails and House File 1729 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Service Omnibus Bill. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just
I just wanted to ask kind of a general question, and maybe you're not going to be able to answer because you're just sitting in for Representative Dean, but this bill just made me wonder. We don't have a fiscal note for this yet, so what will the procedure be when we get the fiscal note? Are we going to bring it back and have another vote on it, or exactly how would we handle that? And, of course, you'll need to get the amendment on it, too, so what would be the process for this?
Representative Liebling, it's my understanding that this bill will be brought back when it has a fiscal note, and will be addressed again with the amendments and everything get it in its proper order.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Zerwas again?
Do you want me to do mine again?
Yes, Representative Zerwas. House File 1053, since you're so nice to be up there, Representative Zerwas will move House File 1053 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Service Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. File 1053 deals with a glitch in the competitive bidding process that disproportionately impacts the medical equipment that many families rely upon to keep their children out of the hospital and at home. And so I won't belabor the point. We have a few testifiers that I'll turn it over to.
All right, thank you, and welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We are glad to be here today to talk about this important issue. My name is Sarah Anderson. I am Vice President of Sales at Key Medical Supply and a board member for Minnesota Association of Medical Equipment and Suppliers. We're here again today to talk about an issue that we have worked with the legislature, the governor's office, and the department on for the previous 2 years. We have been successful working together in delaying the impact of the Medicare competitive bidding program on the Medicaid program and its recipients, and we're here today to propose a permanent solution to this problem. Medicare, as we know, is a program that is obviously a federal program. It is designed for seniors. Its policies and procedures are written with those that are over 65 senior citizens in mind. And those policies, when overlaid on individuals with disabilities or individuals younger than 65, have some very dramatic effects. My co-testifier today is going to be able to illustrate personally what those effects have been in her son's life, and so I will allow her to illustrate that. Just briefly, I want to talk a little bit about the Medicare Competitive Bidding Program. What it has done is resulted in a 46% cut to some very critical products and services. Again, when the basic pieces of equipment in these categories, commonly used by seniors, sustain this cut, it is very impactful for seniors. When the specialty products and services in these categories sustain this kind of cut, the result is complete and total loss of access to these products and services. I'm happy to, because we've talked about this issue in the past in both the policy and in previous years, I'm happy to take specific questions on the bills after my colleague, Mrs. Harris, has an opportunity to illustrate the impact that this bill will have.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for taking the time to listen to my story today. I think some of you heard about my son Joshua. I testified about a week or two ago. Joshua was born prematurely and had a grade 4 brain hemorrhage at birth, and so subsequently he has cerebral palsy, spastic quadriplegia, what's called tracheal malacia, so his airway closes, it shuts down, so he needs a trach tube. Because he can't swallow effectively and efficiently, he needs a what's called a gastrostomy tube or a feeding tube for all of his nutrition. He also relies on equipment like BiPAP at night for sleeping to expand his lungs and so forth. And we've had, Josh is 22 years old. We were told that he would only survive for 2 months, so we decided to take life 20 minutes at a time. So here we are, about a million bazillion 20 minutes units later. But technology has changed incredibly since Josh was born. And And I'm proud to say as well, so have attitudes toward people with disabilities. And so we realize now we don't have to have those old-fashioned notions of disability, that people with disabilities, and children in particular, can live very productive, content, happy, and meaningful lives. And in order to do that, in Josh's case, what makes him different is that he relies upon his tracheostomy, he relies upon his tubes, he relies upon the pump that delivers the formula to him and so forth. He relies upon the machine that expands his lungs. But that doesn't define him. He's a very content, happy young person who participates in the community and is very well known in our hometown of Eagan. So historically, Medicare, and Josh, when he turned 20, because he has disabilities and my husband is retired from 33 years in the Marine Corps and also from a civilian job. So because when Josh turned 22, he had to start using Medicare as a primary insurer. And so what happened then is the rules that apply to Medicare and to the demographic that Medicare was designed for do not apply to a young person who has really taken acute problems or acute conditions and made them chronic. And so basically, in order to thrive and to continue to participate in the community, Joshua really relies upon everything that we're provided by our providers. And sometimes it's out of the goodness of their hearts because they're not compensated for doing that. At the same time, Josh can't have those things taken away and still live. And he's such... We have three boys, and they're all extremely important to us. But Josh has really had an impact, not just on our lives as parents, but on his brother's lives and the entire community, and as well as his peers in the Eagan school system. So while Medicare is kind of fashioned to take care of people at end of life, Josh is just beginning his life, really. And so those rules don't apply at all. And because his conditions were sustained at birth, so in childhood, he's going to use all of this equipment for a long time. It's not just going to be 6 months, and then there's an end to it all. And so it's not okay for Joshua to go back to kind of some of the very primary rudimentary equipment that they used before he was born. So, for example, and I've heard a number of families talk about their concern about this, they might have a young adult, a child with a developmental disability who has what's called a button. They have a button there in their tummy, and they're able to set up a tube and feed the child through the button. Well, if we were to look at what the Medicare rules provide, they would have to have like a catheter, what you're all familiar with, a long catheter just hanging out at all times, which gets caught in the wheelchair, it gets pulled by people inadvertently, and a person with developmental disabilities just looks at that, perhaps, and just wants to yank it out. So it's a safety measure as well. I know that before Joshua had the expert and fine nursing care that he's had for the past many, many years, we had a provider, and before he had a feeding pump and before he had a button, we did have a provider just lay him down when he was a tiny little thing and open up his tube and pour in about double what he could handle, what he typically now takes over about an hour and a half. And he essentially drowned in his formula. And so he was in the PICU for months. They weren't able to get in touch with my husband because he was away with the Marine Corps on whatever they do. They don't tell us, but he was doing that. They couldn't get in touch with him. And so with dragging two other small boys to the PICU every night, because this is what happened, because Josh did not have access to a feeding pump and the right equipment at the time. And we don't want to go back to that. It'd be very difficult to go back to that when we've already established such a wonderful life for him, the way things are now. So Right now, our family, because of competitive bidding, my husband and I manage about 8 different providers. And I have to start thinking about Josh, like in terms, I have to start at his head and go all the way down to not only remember the diagnosis, but to see, but to remember, okay, this is the company that handles his trach and his respiratory. This is the company that handles his what's called intral or his feeding supplies. This is the company that handles his orthotics. This is the one that does his wheelchair. And so in addition, and Josh needs 24-hour nursing care, so you can't fall asleep, you can't, you know, you can't go unconscious or anything. You have to be there providing for him, and we do have nursing help, but our family does a lot of that ourselves too. So in addition to that, we're managing 8 agencies to keep him alive. And so, and it's because of competitive bidding, we're kind of, it's splintered. And so it made a very trying situation, even though it's a joy for us to have Josh and be able to do it, but it made it almost impossible. And so I'm usually not one to break down so easily about those medical things after all that we've been through, but when we found out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, on a Friday, that we could no longer receive formula for Joshua because of competitive bidding, and our service provider could not get it for us anymore, and we had literally enough formula to last the weekend, and we can't just give Josh a cheeseburger and say, you know, just eat this, you know, I know you haven't eaten in 20 years, but try it. So I was frantic, and I spent hours on the phone in tears trying to figure out what to do until a provider finally kind of came in to us kind of like a superhero and said, we'll get formula, we'll get a feeding pump, we'll provide your tubing. And I know that they probably do that at a loss, but it keeps Joshua alive. And so I think because medical assistance, and Josh is on a waiver for people with complex medical needs, it's a lifeline. Medicare provides something, and they do what they're supposed to do for their demographic, but their demographic is not kids like Josh. And that's where medical assistance picks up and keeps our kids alive. And so that's why what Sarah was saying is so vastly important. I know when you start kind of like looking at pieces of medical equipment and talking about it, it kind of is like, oh, okay, whatever. But it really is, it's a tangible thing in our lives, and it makes every bit of difference. So I just thank you for your time and ask you to consider this bill.
Ms. Harris, thank you for your testimony. We do have a question from Representative Lane for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering if you could explain more what you meant by, because of competitive bidding, you were having difficulty. What did you mean by that?
Well, we had one company that provides, like, they provide Josh's respiratory equipment, so his ventilator. Well, and he doesn't even need to be actually on a ventilator. He's on what's called BiPAP, which is kind of like CPAP, which is more familiar. But because of competitive bidding, that to stay with that provider and to get the education and the interaction that we get that keeps Josh safe and trains his nurses, in order to stay with that company, he needs to be now on a ventilator that is probably much more than he really needs. But they're not allowed, because of competitive bidding, just to use a standalone BiPAP. You have to use like a ventilator and put it on BiPAP settings. So with competitive bidding, they were told they could no longer, or they weren't one of the winning low bidders, so they could no longer provide any of his feeding supplies. They provided most all of his respiratory and feeding supplies, and they could no longer do that because of the Medicare competitive bidding. So we had to suddenly try to find a provider that would take Josh, but most of them that were approached, I think about 5 providers rejected him, and they did say, we don't see that it fits his needs, that he needs to have a feeding tube, even though he's never been able to eat to sustain himself. He can't swallow. He has a tracheostomy. But because they had to split off that service and it had to go to a low bidder, we couldn't get his feeding supplies any longer. And nobody really wanted him until we finally found a provider that ethically and in good faith took us on. So.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, I think, and I apologize, I didn't maybe step back and give a good enough basic intro, and maybe the other testifier can touch on this a little bit too, but the idea of competitive bidding, we all want to make sure that for where public money is going, what public money is paying for, that we're getting a good value and a good deal and a good rate. The issue is what we're seeing in Minnesota as this is implemented in Minnesota within this very defined area of this durable medical equipment. The vendor amount is so small that in some of these items are so specialized and so specific that when you start doing competitive bidding, there aren't enough vendors to provide adequate service at a cost that keeps the vendors in business. And so while in many parts of the country in many different product categories or service categories, this works very well, this really falls outside of the norm in what people from MAMES and other groups are coming to the legislature saying year after year is this is an unsustainable model for our industry in this area. And I don't know if the testifier wants to touch on that a little bit more, but I think that background might be a little bit helpful.
And if you could please restate your name, I missed it the first time.
Certainly. Sarah Anderson.
Thank you.
The button device that Josh utilizes that Ms. Harris has described, just using that piece of equipment as an example, prior to Medicare's rate system, which was competitive bidding, that product was over 300, it was reimbursed by Medicare at over 300% lower than the lowest acquisition price that the manufacturer sells it to any healthcare entity, including the VA, in the United States. The competitive bidding process cut that rate by 46%. So Medicaid recognizes the critical need that product serves for people with disabilities. It is not a commonly used item amongst a senior population, but it is extraordinarily common used with individuals with disabilities. So Medicaid has set a specialty rate, and the legislature worked to protect that specialty rate in 2009. That is the kind of thing that we're talking about. The access elimination is a result of these bids that were collected from companies wanting to serve a geriatric population. In the case of her son's formula, of Josh's formula, we're not talking about Ensure or Boost or some kind of an enteral nutrition that we could go out and pick up off of the grocery store shelves. This is a highly specialized formula for a metabolic need that is very infrequently utilized amongst the general population or even amongst the tube-fed population. It is much more common in the disability population. And so having these rates that were set by companies that were specifically bidding for a senior geriatric population imposed on a program that is designed for individuals with disability, non-geriatric population, is where the providers who can't offer services for these products anymore at those rates. In the packet that we the page distributed, there's a picture, a graph, or a map, and this is just an illustration for you of all of the DME providers in the metropolitan Twin Cities area. That's where Medicare's program is currently implemented, is just in the 11 county metro area. For the category of CPAP supplies that Josh relies on, CPAP and BiPAP supplies, there were a total of 37 vendors who agreed to the rates that Medicare offered. Only four of them are within 50 miles. So the access restriction that's created by the companies who are willing and currently accepting these rates is real. And the flyer that you have shows the extreme reduction in the number of providers that take place at this new rate. So I hope that answers your question, Representative Lane and Representative Zerwassel. Feel free to elaborate if needed.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Zerwas, the testimony has all been about the unique needs of children, and yet your bill seems to cover all populations, including seniors. And I don't know if it was your intent to narrow it to the specialty services that, you know, the Medicare bidding didn't really, at least by the testimony, address, because, you know, I have not heard any complaints, for example, from the seniors in my area or others that they have not been able to get access to walkers, for example. It says there's six within 50 miles of them within the metro area. And so I'm just wondering, is it your intent to have this apply to all medical equipment for all populations of all types, or was it really to try and focus it on what we've been hearing about, which is the specialized equipment that needs to be customized for people with unique disabilities and particularly for pediatric patients?
Well, in the case of Josh Harris, Josh is no longer a pediatric patient, so he's a specialized an individual with a specialized disability, but this does not just apply to pediatrics. What we're really talking about is the Medicaid population in general. We didn't carve out a particular age group, but those that are non-dually eligible relying on medical assistance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas.
Members, I think we're hearing about this, and I think rather than looking at a pediatric versus adult, I think the correct way is chronic versus the acute need. And so what we're seeing through the miracle of medicine is we're seeing a patient population of very, very sick and now chronically sick patient population that years ago, quite frankly, wasn't expected to live long enough to have a chronic illness, but as in the case of our testifier's son, was most likely expected to pass away pretty shortly after life, and through just miracle upon miracle, we've been blessed with the ability to keep these folks alive. And so while we refer to our son as a young man, he's 22 years old, he's an adult, and so I think what I wouldn't want to do is say we want to give patients access to this critical equipment until their 18th birthday and then say, well, you've had a good run. I think what we want to do is understand that this is fantastic news that we're able to keep people alive and help them manage some of these chronic illnesses. And so while we've had parents and caregivers here to speak to this bill, we need to understand that this isn't a pediatric population versus an adult population, but we're talking about chronic disease management.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Loeffler.
I had mentioned disabled or pediatric, because I thought those were the kind of distinctions you were making, where because of your physical needs, you need to have very customized sort of equipment. But my understanding is that this would also be the provision of walkers for someone who's on MA, who's just having a knee replacement and is going to use a walker for 6 weeks or 8 weeks or, you know, not. And so I just was trying to understand if you were really trying to focus your bill or if you really just wanted it, everybody who uses medical assistance, durable equipment, and now I think I understand your intent in the bill is to have it apply across the board.
Ms. Harris.
Thank you. I thought maybe I could give an example. Joshua he's 22 years old, but he's about the size of an 8-year-old. And he has a trach tube, and he has high muscle tone, so he has a tendency to just keep his head kind of like this. It's kind of, that's what's comfortable for him. We found out that he probably was doing that because initially he had a trach tube that was kind of a hard plastic, and it was in the way. He doesn't have much of a neck. And so he's got a tiny little neck, kind of like my husband, who's a Marine, who just has a head and shoulders. But, so he has to kind of keep his head like this. Well, because of technology, they now have trach tubes that are called HyperFlex. And so they're very, very kind of flexible and soft, and they're longer. And so now Josh has that kind of trach tube, and now he doesn't cough. He doesn't have to be suctioned just because he moves his head. He can move his head and look at people any direction. It's such a small thing from the outside, but it really has changed his life. And under Medicare rules, there wouldn't be very many providers who we could get that trach from anymore. We'd have to stop and go back to the old-fashioned trach, you know. So that's a little bit of an example, Representative Walker. Thank you.
Representative Murphy. Okay. All right. Seeing no other questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify? Please
come forward and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I certainly will.
I've been waiting to team up with Zerwas anyway. My name is Mark Hughes. I'm a 12-year member, former member of the Minnesota State Council on Disabilities. And believe it or not, the ACA and this durable medical goods has been a big issue. Matter of fact, Sarah Anderson and I have had some conversation over it. And the fact of the matter is that if you're in a big business like that and you have overhead, you employees, vehicles like every other business, and you have to take a 46% cut, you're not going to do it. And it's that simple. At the same token, I look at it from a disability standpoint, and I take a good look at it, because you've then gone from 12 or 15 providers in the Twin Cities or better down to about four. One of those might be in Duluth, which is 150 miles from here. And so the accessibility doesn't really work out because you only have four providers. And for those of us that work, it's not always easy to get in the middle of the day out to get your wheelchair fixed and so forth and so on. And to let Medicare or government run a program like this, the other concern that I had is you might order a wheelchair and get a Florida-built wheelchair that would work in Florida, not Minnesota. Now, there is a difference. Florida, obviously, the weather isn't as severe as it is here. You have to have a much more durable wheelchair here in the Midwest, and there's a real difference. That was also a concern of ours, too. And I wish, in the very beginning, this would have all been taken into consideration, because we wouldn't be here today probably talking about it, because we would have had roughly the same program that we've always had, where we've had good providers. You have really put a damper on the disability community by doing this. We might save money, but you got to show me where we're saving money, because I think you're going to make more mistakes than you save money. Thank you.
I'll renew my motion.
All right. Representative Zerwas renews his motion that House File 1053 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. House File 1053 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Franzen, you ready with your bill?
Yep. Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's better.
All right, next up will be Representative Franzen's House File 1013. Representative Franzen, would you like to move your bill?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 1013 to be laid over for possible inclusion into the finance omnibus bill.
All right. Representative Franzen moves House File 1013 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Franzen, to your bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House File 1013 raises the medical assistant rates paid for four critical home care services: skilled nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy. There has been much discussion in recent years, and this session in particular, about the need for our state to increase our ability to meet the health care needs of older Minnesotans and with those with disabilities in their homes, as opposed to more costly and isolating hospital-based settings. Being able to provide the specific health care services of skilled nursing, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and speech therapy to these individuals in their homes is key to enabling these individuals to stay in place at home. And home health care provider organizations from around the state have worked hard to be able to offer these services at a high quality level. However, skilled nursing and therapy visits provided to older Minnesotans and those with disabilities in their home are reimbursed under medical assistance at such low levels as compared to the actual costs that maintaining the necessary quality infrastructure in Minnesota is becoming a significant challenge. House File 1013 proposes to raise the rates paid for these services to a level reflecting the actual cost of providing the services, and in doing so will preserve the existing access to home-based skilled nursing and therapy services, as well as increase access in areas around the state. I have with me Jay Jones from the Minnesota Home Care Association to briefly discuss the need for this bill.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jones. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Dean and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jay Jones, and I work at a small Medicare-certified agency in Lakeville. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Home Care Association, and we're in strong support of this bill. The Home Care Association represents 180 Minnesota home care providers across the state committed to high-quality home care services. You're all aware of the structural issue Minnesota faces of how to best meet the health and long-term care needs of the growing number of older Minnesotans and those with disabilities in the face of the economic realities our state faces. To provide the best match for each individual's needs and preferences, we need a range of home and community-based services, including home care, to keep people out of more institutional-based settings. Our capacity to provide these services must grow steadily over the next two decades. However, our services can only grow if we're able to attract and retain experienced staff, continue to upgrade our technology, and maintain our financial stability. As a state, we must recognize that achieving the required additional capacity will require selective investments in community-based care. One such investment is the nursing and therapy rate rebalancing we're proposing in House File 1013 to better align MA reimbursements with the cost to deliver the services, especially in rural areas. These skills are critical to the effectiveness and safety of home-delivered care. We're asking for adjustments only for those visits that are paid a fixed amount, the same fixed amount no matter how far we must travel, the same fixed amount no matter how long the visit takes. The proposal builds on Bureau of Labor Statistics and salary survey data for average wages for these professionals in Minnesota. Home care agencies don't set these wages. The market sets them. So adding typical amounts for the required unemployment insurance, workers' comp, Social Security, benefits, agency overhead arrives at the cost figures we've shown. We're happy to provide additional information if you'd like. This problem is not new, but it's becoming more important as MA covers an increasing percentage of our elderly and persons with disabilities. What impact have we seen this problem cause? Many small and mid-sized agencies, rural agencies, and some county public health agencies no longer have therapists. They can't afford them. They must refuse clients needing these services or use subcontractors, making costs for a visit even higher. Minnesota's ongoing innovation and reform initiatives will suggest new ways to achieve better integration across the continuum of care and better alignment across payers to improve outcomes and reduce costs, but any long-term solution will depend on maintaining a healthy, robust infrastructure of community-based services upon which we can build. Thank you for your consideration, and I would ask for your support of House File 1013.
Thank you. Are there other questions for the testifier? All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none. Other questions for Representative Franson? Representative Franson, anything to wrap up before we vote?
There was an amendment to the bill that the department had clarified some language that were not, it was too late to bring to the committee today. So if you're interested, it just... deletes services and therapies on page 1, line 1, and to insert home care services as defined under the section 256B, 0651, subdivision 1, paragraph D, and that's what the fiscal note will be based upon.
Okay, Representative Franzen, I'm sorry, I didn't see that in the stack, that will not be able to be included in the bill itself, but we are going to pass it out so that members have that and have an idea of what the intent of the amendment is. Are there any questions on that? We pass it out. Mr. Berg, is the fiscal note tied together with this A1 amendment? Can you describe that, please?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly the case. You'll note that this is a preliminary fiscal note, not a final note. The reason is the note is been put together based on the bill with the amendment that Representative Franzen described that limits it to home in community-based settings. The fiscal note couldn't be signed off on in its current state because the base language of the bill doesn't match it. But with Representative Franzen's amendment, this note should be correct. And it shows costs in the $51 million range for a biennial.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And for Mr. Berg, is that $52 million a biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes. It's $51 million in the first biennium and $52.5 million in the second.
Oh, that's not
all right, with that, Representative Franzen renews her motion that House File 1013 be recommended to be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 1013 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Franzen and Mr. Jones, for your testimony. All right. Representative Baker, if you are ready, please get your bill ready. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker. You are here with House File 1651. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
All right. I will go ahead and move House File 1651 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform Committee. Is that your wish for the bill, Representative Baker?
That is the intention, Mr. Chair. However, I think we had a clerical issue with the DE amendment that was inserted, did not end up to be the right one. So if we can proceed. I think our next stop is HHS reform.
Yep. What I'm going to have you do, Representative Baker, is just go ahead and describe the DE1, and they will put it on in reform, if that's all right.
I'll have you do that. And I will do that. I'll have my testifiers do that in just a minute. If I could just give opening statement, Mr. Chair, and we'll go from there.
Thank you. Please proceed, Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure and an honor for me to help carry the bill 1651, also known as Steve's Law. And I want to also give a lot of credit to some folks that have helped me kind of take this step along with Representative Hurtaz, Representative Neuberger, and the folks from Steve's Foundation, Steve's Law Foundation. And I think that, you know, some of you know that my story is personal as well. And when I heard about this law that was just enacted a few years ago, that Representative Sean, helped me, and thank you. And I think it was a great bill that I was moved to tears, actually, in orientation when I was getting ready for this new job of mine. And I think that we have a bill here that actually continues the step and the process of getting more of this information, more training, and more product out to all of Minnesota. And I'm very proud to have some good testifiers here today to show what we can do and what we can do with very limited dollars. But we've got a very good plan in front of us, and I will turn it over, if I could, to is it you first? Or okay, very good. So, Mr. Chair, we're ready to go.
All right, you have two testifiers. Please proceed in any order that you would like. Introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. It is my honor and privilege to be back before you again this year, and I want to just start by thanking you for your good work last year in unanimously passing Steve's law. We're incredibly fortunate to have to live in such a great state with such good people in our leadership roles. So I know that the bill that you have before you says $850,000 in appropriations. The amendment that's going to be brought forth will be $250,000, and we will be requesting that matching grants will be offered by the grantees that get the money to implement Steve's law. So I'm going to go ahead and explain to you what I mean by that. In our state, we have 33,000 first responders. Of that 33,000, roughly around 10,000 of them are law enforcement. We have seen that less than 5% have implemented Steve's law. This is a really big problem because if you look at the packet that we've given you, you can see that statistically we're still rising in deaths. We've had a little bit of a dip since 2013, but it's still an enormous problem. It's really driven, as you know from last year, by the prescription pill epidemic. Some 65% of people that start using heroin start with prescription pills. And if you look, you'll notice that nearly 210,000 prescription pills for opioids were dispensed in March alone of 2014. So we're looking at our state, that's just in our state, we're looking at a huge problem in our state still. What we know to be true is that in 2013, 169 people overdosed and died in just Ramsey and Hennepin alone. And in 2014, of just overdose deaths that occur out of the hospital in community where it's solely an opioid, not mixed drug toxicity, so not opioid and a benzodiazepine, but just an opioid, a prescription pill, and or heroin, 179 died in Minnesota. We see that the age group that this is impacting, and I think this is interesting because why we're not seeing first responders carry, I believe, is because there's still a great stigma around addiction. So what we're seeing is that they're just not choosing to implement it. They're not choosing to spend their budgetary dollars on it. So with this appropriation, we're asking that we give them a one-time kickstart to have funding dollars in order to create training for officers and first responders, volunteer fire departments, so that they can really get started with their carrying of naloxone. The funding dollars would go towards education, as well as if counties or if agencies determine that they need some funding dollars to purchase naloxone, that could be decided upon. The cost of naloxone itself has increased 65% for the nasal since August. So the cost has gone from when Sheriff Stanek's agency implemented this in August, it cost him roughly $10,000 to train 23 deputies. That was because, number one, he had to pay a medical director $1,500 to create the training. But also he had to pay to have his deputies do overtime for the training, and he had to purchase the naloxone. At that time, naloxone cost him roughly around $16 to $19 a dose. Right now it's at $46 a dose. So that's huge, but I don't want to take up too much of your time. I really want to just give you information that you need right now. The other things I want to tell you is that the Steve Emmer Hope Foundation, which I'm vice president of, we have a doctor who's here to testify before you today, Dr. Paul Satterley, and he'll give you his background himself. Dr. Paul Satterley has agreed to write the standing order for our entire state's first responder agencies that do not have a medical director. So that gets rid of the fee of $1,500 for each agency. And I know that in rural areas, people are twice as likely to overdose on prescription pills in rural Minnesota. So it's really important that we remove any cost barriers to our rural communities as well as our metro area. Dr. Paul Satterley has agreed to write the standing order, which we will house on our website, which will be free for any first responder agency that needs it in our state. They can have it for free. Dr. Paul Satterley has also agreed to to develop a training that we are happy to work with all the entities that would regulate that to have it be the highest standard. So, for example, POST. We're happy to have it run through POST so that we make sure it meets the highest credentials in our state so that should law enforcement choose it or should ambulance choose it or the fire department choose it, it is of the highest quality and meets the needs of our first responders in our state. With that, I could probably continue to talk for hours on this subject, but I will stop and move on to our next testifier, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the packets. If you have any further questions, just let me know.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Holtham. Dr. Satterley, if you would like to come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Satterley.
Mr. Chair, if I could interject for just a second here. Representative Neuberger's actually got to get back to his committee in Jobs and Energy, if it's all right. Could he testify in advance of this, please?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sorry, Representative Neuberger, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you, Dr. Satterley. Dr. Satterley was one of my former medical directors, and I count him as a friend, and he's a real blessing to this state. And I also want to say thank you to Representative Sean, who really led the charge on this. You did a good job. Good work. The whole Narcan issue, it's something I'm very familiar with. As most of you know, I'm a paramedic. I've been one for 27 years at a Level 1 trauma center here in the metro. I have personal experience using Narcan. I have said in the past that I've pushed gallons of Narcan. That's not an exaggeration. I have used Narcan many, many, many times on patients. Simply put, it's very safe and it works. You can reverse someone who's in a deep overdose really quick. What we're needing now is when we went sine die last session, we were real hopeful that we would see this on the street. We're not seeing it used as we would like to because of the barriers that we're identifying today. And with this, the passage of this piece of legislation, we'll be able to get the boat moving in the direction that we need. And simply put, members, we do a lot of things that that are good. This is something. It's not good. It's great, and it'll give us an immediate. We'll get immediate results from this. As soon as this gets moving, we're going to see people's lives get saved. And I'm encouraged and I'm grateful, and I just want to thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative Neuberger. Appreciate your testimony. Dr. Satterley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm honored to be here today to talk about this subject. This is important to me. My name is Paul Satterley. I'm an emergency medicine physician at Abbott Northwestern, and for a number of years I was an emergency medicine physician who participated with the ambulance administration. I was part of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board for the state for a number of years. And through that, I've done education throughout the state. I've interacted with law enforcement and fire, and I feel like I have a good handle on this. I've been approached by the Rumler Foundation to be director of their overdose prevention project in order to try to kind of work with first responders, law enforcement, to get this going. And the question that is in front of us is, why does the state need to step in at this point in order to facilitate this process once the grant has already been established? And this is the problem. Anytime you try to initiate new medical anything, there's a slow uptake as people hear about it, think it's interesting, set up some ideas around it. Example would be if you wanted to do some changes in CPR, AED. My estimation is it would take about 2 years for the organic way for that to get throughout our state. And this is something that I don't think anybody wants to wait that period of time for. We want to try to identify the barriers of why people are not initiating this today. Some of those barriers are stigma, and that comes from providers as well. My partner's in the emergency department. Some people think, well, this shouldn't be out on the street. It'll just encourage people to use more. That's my job, to overcome the stigma. Some of the other challenges are finances. I can't overcome that. Some of the other challenges are scheduling and overtime, and I can't do that. But that's what we're asking the state to help with. So if you look at the education of any one of these groups, typically the budget and the agenda set up for the next year, year and a half, they have criteria that they need to have in order to maintain certification. Naloxone education is not going to be on that, so it's going to have a lower priority. They're going to get all the check boxes they need to get every year in order to maintain whatever certification they have. So until a national entity like American Heart or somebody puts naloxone education in their agenda, it's not going to become a standard in a class. Minnesota's ahead of the game, and so we need to make education and make it available, encourage people to take the extra time, the cost that it takes to get this education and get the project and get it out there. And, you know, if we could have the entire state familiar with it by tomorrow, we would start saving more lives tomorrow. But typical process is not going to work that way. So thank you for listening to me talk about this. I appreciate your time, and I hope that you'll consider this bill.
Thanks for your testimony today, Dr. Satterlee. I also see that Representative Hertas has joined us. Would you like to testify on this bill as well? Welcome to the committee, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. And I just wanted to add a couple of comments. The Steve's Law Foundation folks had approached me about carrying this bill, and when I realized that Representative Baker had his own personal loss and attachment to this effort, I wanted to make sure that he could do that. And when we looked at the original components of the bill, I thought it was very expensive and overly ambitious in terms of what really needed to be done. And you know, we didn't need to go down the path of training all of the post officers and whatnot. So I just wanted to tell you that I conferred with Sheriff Stanek, who voluntarily implemented this program on his own last summer. He explained to me how he trained the folks and how he equipped it. I'm happy to tell you that even in my own town and my own district, according to Sheriff Stanek, just a little more than 2 weeks ago, we saved one of my constituents' lives, a female. And so, you know, the action of the drug is such that it inhibits the opioid receptors in the brain from shutting down your autonomic system, and that's why it's so important to have this. It's a drug that can be introduced and given, administered without any fear or risk of having to fear it being given wrongly or that there's an overdose situation. So with that, I hope that we can truly understand with Representative Schoen's efforts in this area last biennium, and this truly is a bipartisan issue, and there's lots of lives that can be saved, and I hope you'll support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Baker.
That's all we have for testifiers. We stand for questions.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? All right. And member questions or comments? All right. Seeing none, Representative Baker, I will renew my motion that House File 1651 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House File 1651 is re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Services Reform. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, thank you, Representative Schoen, for your leadership last year. Thank you so much.
All right. Members, we are adjourned.